This is Mind Shift. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, welcoming you back once again to another episode of this podcast. I am your fellow traveler along the road of deconstruction and discovery. The aim with this podcast is always to help you to learn how to think critically about such things as God, religion, spirituality, the state of the church today, and more. Now, today's episode is a continuation of the chat that we had last week with Valerie Wade. I'm bringing you today a discussion that I had with Deanna Adams, and this continues on this conversation, exploring the subject of Black women and Christianity in the United States. And of course, if you paid attention at all in the introduction to last week's episode, you'll remember that I talked about these two women are contributors to Karen Garth's new book. Of course, she's the Faithless Feminist that was on the podcast last year. Her new book is titled Women v. Religion, The Case Against Faith and for Freedom, and that's coming out on the 1st of June of this year. And as I talked about last week as well, you can pre-order your copy on Amazon, so as soon as it drops, you will have your edition of Karen Garth's new book. Karen was nice enough to send me an advance copy, and I started having a look through the book, and I'll tell you right now, it is an amazing book. What it is it's a selection of essays written by numerous different women, and they are looking at the way women have been treated not only historically but currently as well in all three of the Abrahamic religions, that is Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, I don't want to get too much into the contents of the book because next Friday, I am bringing you a chat with Karen Garst herself. We're bringing the Faithless Feminist back onto this podcast, and we're going to be going through kind of what the whole book is about. And we're going to get into some of the topics, some of the specifics of the book. So stay tuned for that coming out next Friday. I'll just say, too, before we get into the conversation with Deanna, that there's some different ways you can get a hold of me on social media. Probably the best way is to look me up on Twitter at MindShift2018. And I'm going to post, as always, the other social media connections in the show notes, as well as those for Deanna Adams. But before I bring you that chat with Deanna, I thought it'd be helpful to provide some more definitions. If you remember from last week's introduction, I got into the definitions of systemic racism and what that's all about in terms of American society and its history, and how that history, that legacy, has played out right up until today. And one of the interesting things that Deanna mentioned in our pre-recording conversation a few weeks before we actually did the recording here was she mentioned that she was a womanist. Now, I'd never really heard of this term. I'd heard, of course, of feminism, and I thought I knew what that was all about, but it turns out I really didn't know that much about it, and I'm glad that I can have a conversation with a person like Deanna and also Valerie as well last week, and she kind of brings me up to speed on this. We're going to get into that in a minute in this episode. One of the things that I uncovered in doing some of the research for this podcast episode today, talking to Deanna, because like I said, she mentioned womanist, so I went and looked that up, and I found that for women of color in particular, there's three forms of discrimination that they most often experience, and they are racism, second, classism, and third, sexism. Now, let's take a minute and look at these things. Each one is kind of interesting in the sense that it's like two sides of the same coin. First of all, you have racism or racist theory. What is it? Well, it's the idea held by one people group or race that their race, their group is superior for some natural, biological, and or cultural reasons. And of course, here's the other side of the coin, conversely, that other races are inferior, similarly for biological and or cultural reasons. And if you take a closer look at this racist ideology or racist theory, what you'll find is the people that hold that their race is superior, they feel like these inferior races are able to be discriminated against, and that's what we see. They're often subjected to discrimination, lesser economic potential, you have lower wages for the same jobs, politically, there's underrepresentation, etc., by these so-called superior, in air quotes, these races who want to retain control politically, economically, socially. And then you have classism, this belief that people from certain social or economic classes are superior to others. The idea that society is or should be composed of class layers. And we see that, of course, right here in Great Britain. There's been a long history of this class divide, you know, the nobility at the top. Then you have the upper class, the upper middle class, the middle class, and then the working class down around near the bottom. And so when you look at the issue of people of color on this class scale, historically they've fallen near the bottom too, maybe even below the bottom, as it were. And while some of this is changing, and that's obviously a good thing, isn't it? But there's certainly an awfully long way to go. Now, when we look at the final issue, this issue of sexism, here we have yet another aspect of discrimination that women of color have long been subjected to. Sexism is this belief that one sex, one gender, and it's usually the male, this idea that the male sex is naturally superior to the other, to women, and therefore on that basis, men should dominate all these important areas, you know, political, economic, social life. And what we see in the past anyway, that sexist discrimination, certainly in the United States, it's denied opportunities to women in a lot of the spheres of activity. And a lot of people say it still does. Now, that's just generally applied to women overall. But then as you add in these other two layers, classism and racism, when you put that into this issue of sexism, you have discrimination simply based not only on your gender, but also the color of your skin as well. And so for an African-American woman, for a woman of color, this is incredibly difficult. It's got to be. And I suspect that many people listening have no idea. I mean, I'll be honest, I don't have any idea what it's like to experience discrimination on really any one of those levels. I've never been discriminated against because of the color of my skin or my gender or as my in terms of nationality or my class. And so it's hard to understand. And that's why it's good to be able to sit down at this table with Deanna Adams and simply listen to her point of view. Let's jump into her frame of reference and find out what it's like to be an African-American woman, not only just growing up in American society in general, but specifically as it relates to the church, as it relates to the history of the civil rights movement and how that has played into determining the culture of African-American churches and their treatment of women today. So let's go on into the conversation. I'm bringing you now part two. This is Deanna Adams as we talk about Black women and Christianity in the United States. I am so happy to be joined by Deanna Adams. Thank you so much for joining us, Deanna.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, you're coming to us from Houston, Texas. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
You have contributed to Karen Garst's new book, The Faithless Feminist. Can you tell us what's the title of the book, her new book?
So the title of the book is Women v. Religion, and it's basically the case of kind of making a case for women to get out of religion and get out of, you know, that bondage that religion, specifically Judeo-Christian religions in the United States, but get out of that cycle.
So this is a different kind of a focus to her previous book, because when she was on my podcast last year, we talked about her book, and it was about women who had left religion, various Judeo-Christian and other religions. But this one is more, you said women versus religion, women v. religion. What's your specific contribution to the book? You've written a chapter for the book.
Right. So to clarify, the official name or title of the book is Women v. Religion, The Case Against Faith and for Freedom.
Right.
So that's the official title. And what I contributed is, along with historian Valerie Wade, we wrote two essays on African-American women and Christianity in the United States, starting from pre-colonial times through the slave trade, through the civil rights movement, and to the present day. And my specific contribution is kind of a sociological history of women in religion, or African-American women in religion, from civil rights period to today.
You're more focused on, what would you say, from about the late 1950s on through to today, sort of that
yes.
time period? But you come out of the church. You're not just someone who's necessarily looking at it from the outside in. Isn't that right? What's your backstory? Because when we talked the other day, you said to me that you don't get into this in your chapter where you came out of the church. So you come out of the church. What can you tell us a bit about your story? Because that's absolutely going to be fascinating, I think.
Right. I have a lot of real world experience with this coming out of religion. I was in the church for about 20 years from the time I was about 11 to 35. And I like to say I left an abusive marriage and an abusive church on the same day. So, you know, I have a lot of experience with being in a bad relationship in church and going to the pastor for help instead of, you know, secular counselors and things of that nature. And the pastor telling me, you know, to just be the best wife I could possibly be and, you know, keep praying for my husband. And maybe he would, you know, become a good man of God someday and stop being harmful, you know. And I finally got to the point where, you know, of course, I knew that this behavior and this treatment was wrong. And I was ready to leave. I was still, you know, going to the pastor for assistance. And, you know, basically the pastor told me, I told her I was going to talk to my mom. I had to go be with my mom and stay with her to get away from this man. And the pastor said, you know, if you walk out of here, I was in her office at the time, and she had called my now ex-husband to meet me there without my knowledge. So, you know, as soon as I saw him walking in, I'm like, that's it, I'm leaving, you know, I can't be here. And she says, you know, if you walk out right now, then you might as well just keep going and never come back. And that's pretty much what I did.
You took her at her word.
Right. You know, I chose myself and I chose my children, and that started my questioning. You know, I didn't immediately say, okay, this whole God thing must be wrong, you know, that day. At first it was, well, maybe this is the wrong church. Maybe, you know, this pastor was just wrong or what have you. But I started doing a lot of research, and I started listening to podcasts and listening to going on YouTube and looking at the arguments for and against religion. And, you know, in all that research, I kind of realized, maybe snakes don't talk, you know, like maybe that really didn't happen. And maybe it's not okay to say that we know snakes don't talk, but that's allegory. You know, there's other things. And, you know, I'm sure you're well aware of all of the inconsistencies in religion. And, you know, it just, for me specifically, it made me angry, because the more, you know, I went through my angry atheist phase. And the more that I realized this is all, you know, not true, this is not okay, the more I saw how it was particularly damaging to Black women in the United States. You know, we talk about in the essay for Karen's new book, the socioeconomic damage that church membership and heavy church membership can do to women who, you know, they go to church 3 or 4 times a week, or, you know, there's unmet needs that are happening in their lives, but they feel like as long as they keep praying about it, or as long as they, you know, keep going to the church or going to the pastor, that it'll eventually be okay. But then it doesn't. You know, I started seeing this not only in my own life, but in the life of, you know, my family members, former church members. It just made me very, very angry to see what kind of damage was being done. So, you know, I was very, very excited to do this essay and this chapter, so that hopefully, you know, I'm past that angry atheist phase, and I'm more kind of, let me just give you something to think about, you know. But hopefully it will give women something to think about. It will help them to kind of form those thoughts that they may have already been having, or, you know, put those doubts into something tangible that they can really relate to, and kind of get them out of that cycle.
Like you, I came out of the church. I was in it forever. I grew up in church. I was a pastor for 12 years in Portland and Oregon. I came out of all that. And then I went through that angry phase where I started to realize, wait, all the investment that I put into this thing, what did I actually get back out of it? I got a lot of toxic teaching. And there's so many people out there, like you said, that have these experience or have had these experiences. And I think people like you writing chapters like this, it gives people the language to be able to describe what they've experienced. So it's really helpful, isn't it, to get these things out there. It's one more voice that's just part of the discussion, isn't it? So you started your deconstruction on this meeting with the pastor. I'm sure she wasn't intending to boot you out the church, but that's unbelievable. They gave you an ultimatum. I have a hard time believing that you have to leave the church, or just, I guess, knuckle under and do what she said.
Pretty much.
Unbelievable.
And the funny thing was, the ultimatum was, you don't need to go and see your mother. And once I heard that, I'm like, something about this is wrong. Why would a pastor tell me I don't need to see my mother?
Exactly.
You know?
Sounds very controlling.
That's psychology in college. You know?
Yeah,
this is abusive language. This is isolation. You know, this is telling you that if you're a part of our group, then you don't need your family and you don't need these other people. I'm like, this is how Jim Jones got all of those people. I mean,
yes.
You know, and so all of those things came into my mind. And that's the thing, too. You know, I mentioned the other day, one of the things is, you know, I'm a college-educated woman. I took psychology of women in college before I was ever married or, you know, anything. And so I knew about the cycle of abuse and I knew about, you know, keywords and those triggers and things like that, you know. So it's not just uneducated people that end up in abusive relationships or uneducated people that end up in these toxic churches. And, you know, I do say at this point that that particular church was a cult because it fit all of the check boxes for a cult,
all the markers.
Isolation and, you know, the, if this is right and this is wrong, and if you don't do this, then you're bad. You know, it fit all of those things. So, you know, they weren't asking us to drink toxic Kool-Aid, but it was still a cult. And I think it's important to mention that, you know, anybody can succumb to those things, regardless of their educational background or their professional background or, you know, things like that. And, you know, that leads me into a point that's really, really important before we move forward is that when I talk to, and I appreciate, you know, even when we spoke the other day, I appreciate your genuine curiosity and respect on this topic, because a lot of people that, you know, we talk to, especially online, will immediately jump to, why are Black people religious at all? Like, that's so stupid. Christianity was beaten into them by the slave masters, and they should totally be against that now, and it makes no sense that they would do that. But it's really, really important to understand that because of the way, you know, our ancestors were basically made Christian, and because of the horrible oppression that they lived under for so many years, you have to have some type of respect for the fact that that was the only thing giving them hope at that time. You know, it's either you accept the fact that we're here for an amount of time and then you die, and you're here right now under slavery, under horrible oppression, under, you know, beatings and, you know, raping and pillaging and what have you, and then you die. Or you say, well, maybe there's somebody in the sky who's going to get us out of this one day. I'd rather take that little piece of glimmer of hope and, you know, continue to move on than just, you know, give up. And, you know, it's really important to recognize that, because I think a lot of people, especially in the atheist community, are very, very disrespectful when it comes to African Americans and Christianity. It's just not black and white. So it's really important to kind of make that distinction there and kind of discuss that part of it.
From what I've understood, they made it their own. They took it on board, even though it was seen in a lot of ways, wasn't it, as a white man's religion initially. It was culturally appropriated, or whatever you want to call it, wasn't it? And you look at like Negro spirituals and songs like that that they were singing. It's funny, the other day, because I got triggered because I used to sing all these songs in Sunday school, and we used to sing the song "We Are Climbing Jacob's Ladder." And I looked up the lyrics for that, and I learned that it was a slave spiritual song. They actually sang it in the fields when they were working and in the church. And I didn't know that. And yet it just kind of filtered its way into the white evangelical churches. So we sang that song growing up as kids, but it's exactly what you described. This idea of them climbing the ladder to heaven, escaping the oppression and the horrible conditions. And that's really what the song is about. I didn't know that. So these things have filtered the way it come around. And so I'm absolutely fascinated by the whole subject of how it all works, you know, from a sociological point of view. So where would you say you're at now? You said you went through the angry atheist phase. You walked away from the church. I love that phrase. You left your abusive church and your abusive marriage on the same day. You went through the angry atheist phase. How would you describe yourself now? What would you say you're at now?
Well, now I'm comfortable in my skin, for one thing. I describe myself as a secular humanist, not because I'm afraid of the atheist word, because I'm definitely atheist too. But I think, to me, atheist is just, it's simple. You don't believe there's a God. That's just it. But being a secular humanist is, I believe that we should separate, you know, people's religious beliefs from law, you know, and from legislative events in the country and in the world. But then also I'm a humanist because I do believe that we are all we have. You know, we as other humans are all we have on this earth, so we kind of need to take care of each other.
Pretty
and,
important.
It's funny, just to double back on what you mentioned about Jacob's Ladder, well, a lot of those songs were actually songs that were in code. So Follow the Looking Gourd, you know, or the Drinking Gourd, sorry, was about, you know, how to get to the north. Follow the Drinking Gourd, which is basically the Big Dipper, so that you find the North Star, and then you're going to the north, and so that's there as well.
Yeah, it is absolutely fascinating. So you describe yourself as a secular humanist. Are you saying then that you're trying to get more in this idea that if you say this is all we have now, we're all we have now, we have to take care of each other,
right?
So that you're bringing in the human element of the whole story rather than just saying there is no God and that's it. Where does that leave you? But you are an atheist, you say, but you're more of a secular humanist. You also said the other day you consider yourself a womanist. Can you talk about the difference between womanism and feminism? Because that's something that I'm very interested in finding out. What are the differences between the two?
Right. You know, like I mentioned the other day, when someone asked me, are you feminist? It's kind of a loaded question, right, for me as a Black woman, because historically, white feminism, you know, and I always put the little air quotes or trademark up there when
yes,
I say,
you have to do the quotes,
is very focused, and it's very, it can be very exclusive, and it can be, it can leave other women out, all women of color, because there's a lot of specific issues that we as women of color, as Black women, as Latinx women, Asian women even, you know, women of color have a lot of other issues that aren't always brought to the forefront. And so what you'll see in, you know, everyday feminism is you'll see discussions of the pay gap, which is important.
Yeah,
and you'll see discussions of, you know, bodily autonomy and things like that. But then you'll also see things like, you know, body hair autonomy. Well, I can tell you that, you know, most women of color really don't kind of care about the body hair. You know, you do you. You know, but
right,
we're concerned more about things that affect our communities, such as, you know, the mortality rate, the infant mortality rate, and the maternal mortality rate. Because, you know, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I can tell you Black women die in childbirth many times more than white women die in childbirth. Especially here in Texas, our maternal mortality rate for Black and Hispanic women is ridiculous. I mean, and there, that's a whole other topic, but
yeah,
they're closing or have closed abortion clinics, but then it's harder to get help when you're pregnant and low income. So, you know, it's this horrible storm of, you know, damage being done to women of color in the state that don't have the resources to, you know, live in an urban center that has, you know, lots of medical options, or to get transportation back and forth, you know, things like that. And so those things are very, very important to women of color and, you know, women who consider themselves womanist. And it's always important to kind of make that distinction, because we need those voices. And if mainstream feminism would talk about those things, then there wouldn't have to be that distinction made. But unfortunately, right now, it's still not, you know, there's some, I would say there's a lot of women that are learning and that are getting to that point in mainstream feminism, and they're kind of raising their voices now, but it's still definitely not, you know, at the forefront like it should be. So that's why I always have to, when someone asks me that question, I have to, you know, talk about a paragraph.
You have to clarify that. Because it seems to me, in the reading I did, the research I was doing, there is an overlap between feminism and womanism, and that issues that relate to all women are covered in many ways by feminists. But what womanism, to me specifically, you know, issues of classism, sexism, racism, that whereas feminism is more of a white women thing, middle class and upper middle class, and they did things like getting the vote for women, and these are obviously important things, and addressing pay gaps and things like that, but most white women have never had to deal with racism, and certainly not systemic racism, which is all, you know, it's the whole point, isn't it? It's shot through, certainly in American society. I don't know how much we want to get into systemic racism, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, at least from what I've studied. It seems like it's every aspect of American society, political, educational, economic. You're going to find ways to oppress people of color, or at least keep them from having those same opportunities that are just naturally afforded to white people. And most of us have never even ever experienced anything like that. We have no idea what it's like to experience racism. We just don't. And it's hard to figure out where to even start the conversation. So what would be your response to all that? Yeah, it's massive, isn't it? It's huge.
Right. You're absolutely right. And what'll happen a lot of the time, because, you know, white women don't have to deal with those other issues, historically, as you mentioned, getting the right to vote. So women got the right to vote in 1920, but black women didn't until, you know, electing her right to vote later. Or at least the right to vote without Jim Crow laws stopping them. And some people would argue that we're still fighting for the right to vote in certain areas because there's voter suppression going on in majority, minority areas all over the country. A lot of times those issues, it's been the feminists in the front have been, okay, we'll get our rights and then we'll come back and get you. You know,
just circle
wait,
back around.
Just let us get ours. Yeah, and then we'll come back. And they never come back.
They never came back.
So we've gotten to the point now where a lot of us are like, okay, we're not waiting for you anymore. We're just going to go ahead and we're going to fight our battles the way we need to fight those battles and, you know, move forward. I'm actually reading now, doing a little reading about the history of Houston in the 1970s and 80s. So the boomtown period and the bust. You know, the oil boom in the 70s and then the oil bust in the 1980s in the Houston area, when it was heavily, you know, relying on the petrochemical industry, and then all of a sudden that went, you know, to heck. And, you know, it's funny, there's places, I'm a lifelong Houstonian, I was born, raised, and trapped here, as I like to say. There are areas that, the book that I'm reading was written when I was 11, so written in 1987. There are areas from that book that were majority black areas that do not exist anymore, and I never knew they existed.
Really?
Whole neighborhoods that were not necessarily affluent, but, you know, they were self-sufficient, majority African-American neighborhoods. One of them right now is on the Beltway, like the area that they describe it. That is a freeway right now. And the other, about 30 miles north of it, is essentially part of the airport. And I never knew, you know, as a lifelong Houstonian who was alive during this time period, never knew these areas existed. So, you know, when you talk about in the North and in the South, you know, I really don't make a difference between the North and the South, to be honest with you. I think one just has more covert racism and one, you know, who's calling you the N-word, you know. But really, what's the difference? But in, you know, all areas, we had redlining, we couldn't buy homes in certain areas. This is even after the civil rights movement. You know, this is after we had the right to vote and after we had the right to integrate schools. And after this, there was still redlining and there was still job discrimination, employment discrimination. The African American unemployment rate is always higher than the white unemployment rate. A lot of times it's double. And it was the exact same way in 1987 when this book that I'm reading right now was written. And so you wonder, okay, what has really changed? You know, we're seeing a lot of the exact same things. And now with, you know, the administration that we have and the people that have been put in place, it's going even farther back when we haven't made as much progress as they think we have.
And we're going backwards now.
Right. So it's a really scary time right now. I mean, we might be in prettier surroundings, some of us, but it's still very concerning what's going on and how the income gap is widening. And, you know, you have a few people getting more and more and more, but the majority of people getting less and nobody in the middle anymore, basically. So, yeah. Sorry, I get a little rambly sometimes.
No, it's really interesting. I was going to say, you used a word, you said redlining. Can you explain what that means? Because I think a lot of people wouldn't know what that term means.
Yes, definitely. Sorry about that. So what redlining is, basically banks and realtors would draw a red line around certain neighborhoods, and you could not sell to black people within or without, depending on how they define their map. You couldn't sell to African Americans or, you know, Latino people in those neighborhoods. So what would happen is we were relegated to areas of town that may not have been as, I guess, may not have as many amenities or may not be as hospitable as far as the environment was concerned. One of the neighborhoods that I was telling you about just a moment ago had no running water as late as 1982.
That's unbelievable.
And so, wow. You know, and we were, it was, you can buy in this neighborhood, but this neighborhood has no running water. And then those neighborhoods would be enveloped, like surrounded at some point by, especially in Houston, because Houston had an expansionist ideology forever. I mean, and it was for years, it just annexed and annexed and annexed different parts. So, you know, it started as like 9 miles wide. I think it said 9 square miles. And then, you know, 100 years later, it was like 400 square miles or 500 square miles. So it was constantly annexing different areas. And when it annexed those areas, what would happen is if there was a black community in one of the areas that it was annexing, richer white communities would surround that community until either, I mean, it's early gentrification, right? Until either that community was just swallowed up and bought out and their young, you know, left to find their fortunes elsewhere and, you know, it died off, or it was firebombed or, you know, harassed or rocks thrown at the church's windows, because there was always a church in these communities, you know, getting back to kind of the point.
Yes.
And multiple churches at that. But, you know, it, once it got surrounded by these affluent white communities, if they wanted that land, they would find a way to get that land.
Yeah, they were going to force them out one way or the other. And they obviously did, because they've got a freeway running through there and an airport and everything else. So those neighborhoods are just physically gone. They're just, they don't exist anymore.
Right. Like I can drive past there and I have, I mean, I'm 41 years old, so you're been here a while. Yeah. I'm driving over history and don't even realize.
Exactly.
You know.
But the more you know, as they say, you now know there's a backstory there too. Well, now what, something we talked about the other day, speaking of churches, you said churches in African American, areas that were firebombed and harassed and everything. You said something about the theology doesn't work, because you could tie it in with everything you just said. You said that if the theology is true, that the churches are preaching this prosperity kind of gospel, this upward mobility gospel, it's not working, because those African American communities are still just as poor, just as disenfranchised as they were in the book that you're reading. So what's that about? How come theology doesn't work?
Theology according never works, to the theory. You know.
Yeah.
But as I mentioned to you the other day, you know, God always has an escape clause. Right?
Yes, you said that.
So if things happen that are good, praise God. You know, he loves you so much that he let this really great thing happen to you. But if things happen that are not so great, oh, well, we just need to pray harder, or he's teaching you a lesson. You know, so there's really no responsibility, you know, even though people will say there is, there's no accountability, let's put it that way, for God, because regardless of whether things are good or bad, he still gets the praise. And so what happens is, you know, and the prosperity gospel is a newer phenomenon. I would say, you know, maybe the 1980s to the present, and that's actually pretty early. It really blew up in like the 2000s. But, you know, there are a couple people starting off with it in the 80s and 90s and things like that. But, you know, what the prosperity gospel teaches is if you pray hard enough, and if you sow this seed in this church, and you know, you give this money and you turn around 3 times and jump up, whatever.
Whatever the formula is. You have to have enough faith and declare certain words.
Right, and things will be good for you.
Yes, God will
bless
you.
You'll get that out. Right. You'll be blessed beyond measure.
Beyond measure.
And what's funny is the church that I came from before, so I've basically been to 3 churches my entire life. When I was a child, from 11 to 18, it was the old school Baptist church that I grew up in. Then after college, I wanted something a little more contemporary, and I did attend the Prosperity Church for probably about 10 years or so, 10, 15 years. And then the last one was the cult that I mentioned.
The cult.
And that was, you know, we started going there because we had a young family and we wanted something more, you know, family oriented, where the pastor would know our name. Because at the Prosperity Church, it was a, you know, 10,000 member church, but I think I spoke to the pastor once in the 10 years that I was there.
Yeah.
You know, and that was where they taught a lot of the sow this seed and do this thing and you'll be blessed and you'll get a house and we're going to pray for this person to be healed of their disease or, you know, and then if the person died from the disease, that was still praiseworthy because that meant that God released them from the disease.
They're in heaven now.
Just let that sink in for a minute.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we're praying for you to be healed, but if you aren't healed, that's okay too, because now you're going to be in heaven and everything's still fine.
There's always an upside. So, and God, exactly. God still has his escape clause. I love that phrase. I've been using it all the time ever since we talked, by the way. I've stolen your phrase. I love it because it really made me realize that's exactly what is going on here. That God's never to blame. Ultimately, there's always an escape clause. And it really hit me when you said that the other day. I thought, I've got to go back and look at this whole thing again because I put some tweets up the other day with your, I didn't reference your name, but I put your God's in, God always has an escape clause. And it's true, isn't it? Where is God in all this? Where is Jesus in all this? And what struck me was this whole thing about, how come it's not working for African Americans? Why are they still, you said, why are they still on the bottom of the ladder? Socioeconomically, politically, educationally, that theology should be working by now, surely. But why isn't it working?
And to get back to that point, and remind me to get your Twitter too. I need that attribution.
Yeah.
But you know, to get back to that point, yes. I mean, African American women have the highest amount of religiosity. You know, whenever there's a study done or a census, you know, 80 to 90% of Black women say that religion is very important to them. And yet, we also have the highest rates of hypertension, the highest rates of diabetes. You know, domestic violence is very, very high in our community. You know, even though Black women as a group have made huge educational strides, I mean, huge educational strides. We, if you take out the incarcerated population, we have still about 1 to 2 percentage points higher of more women than men that have college degrees. We've done really well and worked so hard, and we're still not seeing this supernatural level of health and wealth and, you know, safety. We're still not seeing those things. So, you know, we're doing our part. We're going to school like they told us to do. We're, you know, trying our best to focus and have a career and things like that. But we're still not benefiting from this sowing seeds. And, you know, and that's really frustrating too, because we'll see, I always tell people when I left, you know, they say, well, what happened when you left church? You know, what was the first thing that happened? I said, well, actually, I got more money. Like I literally, you know,
yeah, put money
I had
in
a
your pocket.
Savings account, because all of that money that I was tithing, I was a faithful tither, 10%. And then I would, you know, give an offering above that. So all of that I was already doing, I put it into my savings account. I said, I'm not going to just spend it. You know, let's see what this really adds up to. And oh my goodness, I actually had a savings account that was functional.
You had some money.
For the first time. And I can't, you know, I can't say that I would have had that before because I'm constantly giving my percentage, you know, and I tell people, save 10%, pay yourself first. You know, don't do, we had a church that told us to do 80-10-10, 80% on spending or whatever, 10% tithing, 10% savings. I said, you know what, do 80-20, save 20% and then spend the other 80. Or even better, do 60-40, you know, do as much as you can. But the point is, all of that money was just going into this black hole. And we actually go into the essay where, you know, some people will make the argument, well, at least that money that you're giving to the church is going to, you know, good works and things like that. Well, actually, there have been studies that show that's not always the case. A lot of the church's money, a huge percentage, which is discussed in the book,
a shameless plug for the book.
Salaries.
Yes. It's true. It's the overheads and expenses to keep the church going.
Right.
That's where a vast majority of the money goes. Well, it's in providing the pastor that Mercedes SUV or that Escalade or whatever it is. So the prosperity gospel
or
the Gulfstream jet like Kenneth Copeland has, $60 million jet and his own private runway in the back of his house. That's where the church's money is gone. It's the prosperity gospel's worked really well for them. but not for the average person sitting in the seat who's giving away. Like you said, some of these people are giving away the money they shouldn't be giving away. They can't afford to live.
Right.
These little old ladies, they're flat out broke and they're giving their last dime to the church so Kenneth Copeland can fly his private jet. It's unbelievable. Well, you said the other day something that I wanted to touch base on too. You said church in specifically is harmful to African American women.
Well, we definitely, I delineate a lot of that in the essay and kind of spell it out because that, I know, that is a very big claim to make.
That's huge, yeah.
But it, you know, in my view, it's true. When we as Black women are in church, there are so many different areas of our lives that are impacted by being in that church. So, you know, for example, there's this whole waiting for Boaz mentality that's taught a lot of the time. If you want to be single, that's fine. I'm not saying that singleness is a problem, but when you have women that want to be married, that are looking for a mate, and their pastor's telling them, first of all, don't look at all. God will just bring him to your doorstep or he'll just put him in front of your face. But secondly, when you do find someone or when someone, you know, appears to you, they have to have this quality, this quality, this quality, and this quality. You know, that kind of sets some really high expectations. And especially when most of those qualities are the qualities that are supposedly shown by the pastor, then it kind of sets up that pastor to be that surrogate husband type. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with having standards. I absolutely believe that women should have standards and we should choose wisely. As someone who has not always chosen wisely, believe me, I understand that. But there's something to be said about creating this person that doesn't exist. You know, I've heard so many women say, I'm waiting on my Boaz, and now they're 45, 46, 47. And, you know, while there's nothing wrong with them being that old and never having been married, most of them say that they're not happy because they haven't found a mate. You know, and I think that's really, really important to make sure that everybody understands. As an African-American woman saying this in the essay, you know, one of the things that even one of our editors mentioned was, well, is singleness a problem? Well, no. And that's actually coming from a lens of white feminism, because one of the things that, you know, is kind of thing that they fight against is women have the right to choose and they don't want to be married and they don't have to be married and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when you have a group of people that want to be married, that want to have children, that want this type of heteronormative family life, to tell them that they can't have that unless this mythical man comes into their life is just as harmful as telling someone else who never wants to be married, oh, you're going to be a spinster.
What do you think is the drive behind that? Is it the pastor who's trying to retain control over these single women? What's the thinking behind telling all these women that they have to wait for this mythical Boaz to come along, this perfect person who doesn't exist apparently? Maybe he exists out there, but why do they do that? What do you think is the reason behind that?
I think it's more than just one answer, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's very complex, isn't it?
Because we, you know, have these higher levels of, not to borrow a phrase from Christianity, not equally yoked partnerships when we do get married and have families, and these higher levels of domestic violence and these higher levels of, you know, strife and stress and things like that. I think that in some cases it does come from, okay, how can we fix that? But I think it's wrongheaded to go completely in the opposite direction to say, well, you fix these problems by creating a uniform. And I think the other part of that is control, you know, because I think, I mean, religion was created for control. Let's just be honest. In every major Judeo-Christian religion, the ultimate, I guess, reasoning behind it, the ultimate thing that the leaders get from it is control. They get control over the masses, control over the way they think, control over their money, control over, you know, how they live their lives. So the control part is always in there, as far as I'm concerned, you know, with Christianity. And, you know, if you control the women, then you kind of control the society, especially in communities that do end up being more matriarchal a lot of the time. So if the pastor, you know, sets this woman up to believe that she's got to find a guy who is like this mythical Boaz or whatever, or he has to be just as Christian as her, or, you know, there's memes that are out there that say, find a man who, what is it, find a woman who's so into God that you have to find him to find her, kind of thing. If you find that, then both of you will be in the church now, right? So now you have two members instead of one. And then they're going to have children in their nice little happy Christian family. And then there's going to be more members. And more members equals more money.
It's a win-win.
So, you know, we can't discount that as being a reason at all.
Well, one of the last things I wanted to touch on, I'm aware you're kind of maybe running out of time, but you said something the other day too about it's important to understand African-American examples of atheists in the past, historical examples. Why is that important in this whole discussion?
Right. That's super important because once we realize that we're not the first ones, you know, like we're not the first black people in 2018 that have figured out that, you know, snakes don't talk. There's kind of this otherness, you know, that goes away. I remember when I was first coming out in the atheist circles and still doing my research and all these things, one of the first things that I looked up, you know, my Google search and my YouTube search was, you know, black atheists. And I found, you know, a Facebook page and a website and, you know, a local organization that was just starting as well. And it's really important to know that we come from a long line of thinkers. I mean, way, way back. There's a history there.
Examples
of African-American free thinkers and humanists and, you know, atheists. And, you know, within the civil rights movement, afterwards, in playwrights and, you know, and all of these people are talked about in the chapter. But, you know, there's examples all throughout our history. And it's really important for people to, one, if they're already on that path, to know that they're not alone. I know it's really, really important to me to find that community, because otherwise in your family, especially if you grew up in a family of Christians, you can be ostracized. You could, you know, even if your family still accepts you and lets you come around, because there's some families that won't. Thankfully, my parents or my family didn't just, you know, say, don't come near us, you evil devil worshiper.
Right. They didn't ostracize you.
Still, you know, right. But there are still lots of, you know, little aggressions, microaggressions.
Passive,
like,
aggressive.
Okay, you're into that white folk stuff now, you know.
Oh, I see. Yeah, white atheism.
Right.
So that's the connection then, isn't it? Yeah, I see what you're saying.
A lot of people still think that atheism is a white thing.
Ah, I get it now. I see. So yeah, you're saying there's a very important history of African American free thinkers and atheists as well as the quote unquote white atheist thing.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. And what's funny is there's people that, you know, growing up, I was told this was a great person and this was a wonderful person and this person fought for our freedom. And now I can go back to my family and say, well, you know, that person didn't believe this either, right? You know, so it's important to honor them. And I know when I'm not here anymore, I wouldn't want someone 50 years, not to say I'm as important as like a James Baldwin or a Lorraine Hansberry, but, you know, I wouldn't want someone to say, yeah, that Deanna Adams, you know, she wrote some great stuff, and leave out the fact that I didn't believe in God. Or worse, you know, God used her to, you know, advance whatever. I would just turn over in my,
you know, spin in your grave,
my non-existent grave or what have you. But, you know, so it's really important for one to know that we're not alone, but then also to show others that this is not a new phenomenon and that, you know, people that they respect and people that they have grown up listening to, respecting and venerating were like us as well. So, and that actually, it reminds me of a point we talked about a little earlier about my personal backstory and the humanism. And it's that, like, after I, you know, went through my deconversion and, you know, was really angry about how black women were, you know, harmed by church membership and things like that, I took that and I moved forward with it and I started working in the community. And so that's kind of how I expressed my humanism. I, you know, joined or helped found Houston Black Nonbelievers. I joined Humanists of Houston. I was actually part of the first secular social justice conference that was held in Houston in 2016. And all of those things were important because to me, I felt like, okay, I've got this knowledge now and I know how this can help people. And so my humanism is what tells me to move forward and try to help people with it. And not just with the atheism part of it, but just the human part of it.
That's amazing irony, isn't it? That becoming an atheist is more empowering and more freeing in a way than what religion and what church has done. It's done nothing but put chains on people and do all kinds of toxic, horrible things in terms of mental health. I remember one of our podcast guests, he said when he became an atheist, that's what he said. It was like the chains fell away when he was freed from all the burdens of all the conflicted thinking and the black and white theology and the sacred versus secular thinking and all that he'd been raised with going to Christian school and going to church. And it's just, to me, it's the ultimate irony. So it's amazing to hear you say that. Well, that's what I'm thinking too, is how can people get a hold of you? Because you're doing some amazing things in Houston. What's the best way for people to get a hold of you? What's your Twitter handle? What's the best way, social media wise, to get a hold of you?
Probably these days, because I am kind of relaxing now. But these days, Twitter, definitely. My Twitter handle is DMusings1. So at DEEMUSINGS1.
Right. Okay. So I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Thank you. And my blog is musingsonalimb.com. So musingsonalimb.com, like a tree limb.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'll put those definitely in the show notes. So people, if they want to get a hold of you, they can tweet you on Twitter. They can get a hold of you. They can read some of the articles on your blog and especially go out and get Karen's new book and find Deanna's chapter in there. Listen, this has been amazing. Thank you so much, Deanna. And I know you're busy. You've got things to do, but this has been a really educational, really challenging discussion. I'm really glad we got to meet through Karen, the faithless feminist. So yeah, this has been great. Thank you so much for being on this show, Deanna.
You're so welcome. And thank you so much for having me. And I've really enjoyed our discussion as well. I appreciate your time.
I trust that you enjoyed the conversation with Deanna as much as I did. I certainly did. I learned a lot, and I found a lot of interesting information out. I know now the differences between womanism and feminism, and certainly in talking to her as well as Valerie last week, I don't know about you, but I certainly feel like I've gained a tremendous perspective on not only the African-American experience in terms of going all the way back to slave history days, but also going right through to the civil rights movement, looking at how African-American women have been treated historically in churches, African-American women preachers, African-American atheists, and why that's important. And of course, these topics, along with some other ones, are what Valerie and Deanna and I have been focusing on these last couple of weeks. Now, I want to mention real quick before I let you go that next week, we're going to be bringing Karen Garst back. She's going to be talking about her new book. This, of course, is something that Deanna and Valerie have contributed to. And so you'll definitely be wanting to come back next week and hear what Karen has to say. I'll just mention real quickly that if you found the content of this show or last week's show helpful to you at all, or maybe you just want to help me meet my monthly expenses in bringing you this podcast each and every week, then consider supporting the work of Mindshift. You can go on to patreon.com/mindshiftpodcast to find out how you can be a supporter of this show for as little as $1 a month. So check that out. Also, I would ask too for a favor, please go to iTunes or Podbean and leave a review of this show if you found it helpful at all. That will help with the show's visibility, so I would appreciate it if you would do that. So I'm going to let you go, but thank you very much for joining myself and Deanna this week and Valerie last week as we looked at this issue of Black women and Christianity in the United States. Don't forget, next Friday coming up is Karen Garst, the Faithless Feminist, as we talk about her book, Women v. Religion. So come back. I'll see you next week right here on Mindshift Podcast. Yes,